Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we speak with Susan L. Schulman, the press rep who has a new book out called Backstage Pass to Broadway. We also talk about Romeo and Juliet, Stop Reset, Anna Nicole at BAM, and some other things, so please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Monday, September 23rd, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critcherland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
Hello. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk and Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
With us this evening, we have a special guest, right? Susan L. Schulman, who is the press rep on Broadway, who has a new book out called Backstage Pass to Broadway, True Tales from a Theater Press Agent. Susan, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you. This is fun.
So you've got quite a career of wonderful people that you've worked with.
As a
trip, of course not.
Still kicking.
Absolutely. And you had just had this book and you had this... had this kickoff with Peter down at the Drama Bookshop, and it's really exciting to be able to take your day job and put it in your day and night and 24-hour a day job, I should say, and put it onto the page. So tell us, what was the process? Who inspired you to write the book?
I've been writing it on and off for years, and truthfully, I never thought it would be published. I just thought, oh, I should. People always say, I hope you're writing this stuff down when some dope thing would happen, and at first I didn't, and then at some point I thought, well, maybe I should, because, you know, these stories are so, they're about interesting people, not that I'm the interesting part of it, it's just that it's being seen through my eyes. I was, right. You know, I was there. But over the years, everybody has said to me, oh my God, that, you know, that's so crazy, or that's so funny, or whatever. And so finally I got serious about it, and I started to work on it. And then lo and behold, somebody wanted to publish it. And I thought, well, now I better finish it. And I did.
Well, that's great. Yeah, you know, Michael and Peter have told me about the travails of writing a book. I've never undertaken something like that, but when
I had no idea it was going to be so hard, frankly.
I'm not surprised.
Much harder than it looks.
Yeah. What was the story that gave you the most nervousness about retelling that you thought, oh, maybe I shouldn't tell this one?
Well, before I even get into that, I have to say that when I was writing the book, I was concerned because I for one thing, one doesn't want to be sued and one doesn't want to, you know, go down that path for any reason. But what I did was I told stories that basically happened in public.
Ah.
So I'm not telling stories about a conversation that I may have had one-on-one with somebody.
Well, that's
I'm telling
point.
Stories yeah. about things that happened in front of lots of people. And so the stories about David Merrick and his companion, or the stories about Leslie Ann Warren, which lots of people are finding, you know, fun, were all about things that happened in public. I mean, one day I got a call from Michael Riedel, and he said, I heard that Leslie threw a chair at a producer. And I said, oh, Michael, it must be a very slow news day. What are you talking about? And then I checked, and it turns out she had, and she did it in front of the entire company. So, you know, those are the kinds of stories that I tell, and it's the kind of stories everybody wants to know. Don't you want to know those stories?
Oh, sure, but, you know, we often talk, it's so interesting, because while you're working on this show, obviously, and in fact, we were talking about it recently in terms of Spider-Man, but there are so many other examples. A lot of your job as a press agent, many people would say, is to not tell, you know.
Absolutely. And of course, the things that I'm talking about are things that are in the past.
Right, right.
As you can see, and a lot of them are dead.
Well, one story we didn't get to with the Drama Bookshop, Susan, was about Vanessa Redgrave, which I find very, very interesting, talking about keeping things from people. Want to tell us about that Vanessa Redgrave situation?
Well, she was in a play called The Lady from the Sea at the Circle in the Square, and on stage, just luminescent. She was just mesmerizing. Off stage, she was kind of this, to me, she looked like kind of a large peasant. She had big bones, big hands, big features. She was she looked like a farmer's wife to me. I mean, she was very, very plain in a funny way. And yet, the minute she stepped on stage, her charisma and her talent just were transformed her. What happened was, I kept going to her and asking her if she would do an interview with the AP or with the Times or whoever, and each time she would just say no. And so then I'd try another publication thinking, well, maybe she just has something about the Times. And no, it was always no. And I, at the time, I was working as an associate to a very prominent press agent that you all know, Merle DeBusky. And Merle decided that he should have a tea with her, that he was going to charm her into doing publicity. So I set up the tea. And Merle was being deeply charming, and she wasn't all that charmed, and we weren't getting any place. And so finally, I just couldn't stand it anymore, and I finally looked at her, and I said, Ms. Redgrave, can I ask whether your government or our government has forbidden you from talking to the press? And she just looked at me, and she said, yes.
Hmm.
And I realized, or I assumed, that the conditions for her visa, her work permit, must have been that she could only work in the United States as long as she kept her mouth shut.
And I never heard of such a thing.
Well, evidently that's what happened, because it was not long after she accepted that Oscar and made a pro-Palestinian speech at the Oscars. And so there was a tremendous amount of, emotion around this subject. And evidently that was the condition of her being allowed to work in America.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because I don't remember what show it was. It was quite some years ago, and I don't remember where I was working, but I remember I heard through the grapevine that whomever was going to interview Miss Redgrave, I don't remember if they had to actually submit the questions beforehand, but it was made absolutely clear that all of that stuff, anything remotely political, was absolutely off the table.
Isn't that interesting? It doesn't surprise me, because clearly that was the condition. And, whether it was a spoken or it was I never knew, because that was the end of the discussion. And so I never bothered her again.
I just got the book from Susan about 2 hours ago, and I ran home and read the dream chapter right away.
Haven't you read the entire book yet? I'm shocked. I'm appalled. There's going to be a quiz.
No, but I'd heard about that chapter, because I remember speaking to you at the time, and it's so interesting to read it in a book all these years later. They're really just outrageous behavior of Leslie Ann Warren.
I think the worst one of them is the one where Margaret Whiting and John Pizzarelli are involved, and certainly the one about the ensemble factor of Dream. Why don't you tell us about those?
Well, the ensemble line was that a journalist friend of Margaret Whiting's came to an early preview, and it was Sidney Zion, I'm sure you know, and he called her the next morning and he said, it's the best ensemble I've ever seen on Broadway. And that day, Margaret came to rehearsal, and she told the cast what Sidney Zion had said, that, what a wonderful ensemble it was. And Leslie marched over to Margaret in front of the whole company and said, don't ever say that again. I didn't sign on to be part of an ensemble. I'm a star. And Margaret said, well, Leslie, I'm a star too, but I'm proud to be part of this ensemble. And Leslie, in front of the whole company, said, you don't understand. I'm a big star.
Well,
Margaret Whiting. Margaret Whiting. Margaret Whiting.
The bigger they are, the nicer they are. And that proves that's why Leslie Ann Warren wasn't so nice, because she's not that big, even though she thinks she is. Yeah.
Exactly. And Margaret Whiting, who, believe me, is a big star, just laughed and broke the tension, and we went on. But it was like, how could Margaret Whiting...
One thing you didn't include, Susan, in the dream chapter I noticed was I remember that Scott Wise was in the show and then he wasn't in the show. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you didn't want to get into that or if he asked you not to. Or
no, I actually don't know why he wasn't in the show. Do you? I mean, he did it in Nashville, and then I just assumed he got another job. Was there more to that?
Oh well, I'm sorry. The way I remembered it, he began rehearsals, and then he left, and I just assumed it was because of all the tourists.
Not that I know.
Oh, okay.
I think he was in it in Nashville, but I could be wrong. But yes, because I have pictures of him from rehearsals. But now that you say that, I have to go back and look. But no, not that I was aware of. I mean, if he quit for some reason, I never knew about it.
All right, well, there was enough else going on that didn't have to.
Yeah, I was busy. Yeah.
Well,
I was busy dodging bullets. Yes.
Well, nevertheless, you know, even though Leslie Ann Warren wasn't so nice, she didn't try to molest you as Zero Mostel did.
This is true. You are referring, in fact, to a story that I actually have the photo. When during The Merchant, which was a production that was fraught with disaster right up to and after the star died, Zero Mostel, before the show began rehearsals, or maybe it was during rehearsals, Q Magazine, which subsequently also died, asked to shoot a cover photo of a photo of Zero Mostel for the cover of Q. And after we did the photo shoot, the photographer suggested taking a quick shot of all the people that had helped make the photo shoot happen, and that included me and Z's dresser and some other people. And so I knelt down next to Z, who was perched on a stool, and just before the shutter clicked, he very nonchalantly reached down and grabbed my breast. And I was, you know, a young press agent, and he was a very big star, and he was holding all the power in the production. And as much as I wanted to haul off and belt him, mm-hmm. I couldn't. And as the camera clicked, you can see that my arm is pushing his away. Mm-hmm. And so it happened that it just captured that exact, you know, about a second after he groped me.
Wow.
And that picture is in the book.
And with your very glassy smile, too, I might
add. Yes, very glassy and very nervous and not knowing quite what to do. Now I would probably haul off and belt him, but, you know, not then.
And you
different
have a
time.
Very nice lawsuit as well. Yeah, which brings up the point that there are pictures in the book and there are also replication of window cards. And I was very surprised to see with The Merchant that Zero Mostel's name was in the same size type as his co-stars, John Carpenter? Anyway, John and Sam Levine, you know, I thought that was really, really interesting that he would allow that to happen, because I would think with his ego, he would insist that his name be bigger than anybody else's.
Yeah. I mean, I obviously wasn't in the room when that negotiation took place, but it is interesting because I would imagine Sam Cohn was in there someplace.
Yeah,
in that negotiation. I'm not sure who he represented, but maybe all of them, for all we know. I don't know. But that poster that you're talking about, which is in the book, which was designed by Frank Verlizzo, who is known as Fravor,
sure.
Broadway's top poster designer, who also, lucky me, designed the cover of my book.
Yes,
Frank designed that poster. And in the book, I quote him as to how he came up with that design, which was as he said, he went to the library and he found a picture of an old medieval-looking Jew with a hook nose, and then he put it through the Xerox machine several times to make it break up a little bit, and then he colored it red because, as we all know, David Merrick, red is the most, as he said, red is the most theatrical color. And that poster that I have in my office and is in the book is a collector's item, because that poster, which had Zero Mostel and Sam Levine, and it had, was it the Imperial that it was on, Peter? You know these things.
No, it was, it was in Philadelphia, so it was.
No, that poster was for New York.
They weren't going to the Imperial.
It was the Imperial, thank you.
Yeah, they didn't wind up going there. They didn't wind up going there because they realized they weren't going to have that big a show without Zero.
That's right. And so, but that poster was created, obviously, before Z died, and when Z died, Sam Levine left the show. So that, and it didn't come into the Imperial. So that poster is a real collector's item.
And speaking of which, it's so wonderful. I was so surprised, pleasantly surprised, that all those window cards or posters are produced in full color in the book. You don't see that too much anymore.
Well, I jumped up and down and insisted, because what's the point? You know,
yeah,
if you can't see Bob Gill's poster of Danson and you can't see Frank Verlizzo's poster of The Merchant in color, it loses a lot.
Well, that's great.
You know.
All right. So now Vanessa Redgrave said no to you, but Bob Fosse said no to you quite a bit too, right?
He did. He did. But not the one time I asked him if he would dance with me.
Mm-hmm.
When we were in Boston, there happened to be two other Bob Fosse shows playing in Boston at the same time. And so Fosse asked the company manager and me to make a party. And during this party, Fosse proceeded to dance with every single female dancer in all three companies. And as I watched all this, I somehow got up the nerve. I'm not sure how. And up until then, most of our contact had been me asking him to do an interview and him saying no. So I'd say, Mr. Fosse, he'd say no. So I walked over to his table, got my nerve, walked over to his table, said, excuse me, Mr. Fosse. And he looked up at me with a glint in his eye and he said, no. I said, I didn't ask you anything yet. He said, what? I said, do you only dance with dancers or do you dance with regular girls too? At which point he looked at me, took my hand, led me out onto the dance floor, and proceeded to kind of wrap himself around me for what has to have been the dirtiest, closest slow dance I've ever had in my entire life.
You had it coming.
I asked for it and I got it.
Right. And you have yourself to blame.
Absolutely, but not so bad, because he was pretty hot stuff, Bob Fosse, when he wanted to be. And at the end of the dance, he looked at me as if for the first time and said, Susan, you're a very good dancer. And I said, in this kind of haze of Bob Fosseism, I looked at Bob Fosse and said, so are you, Bob. And it was only about 10 minutes later that I realized how moronic that had sounded, telling Bob Fosse he was a good dancer.
Well,
but after that, he was a lot nicer to me.
Did you tell the story to Richard Chamberlain when you slept with him?
I did sleep with Richard Chamberlain.
Go on.
Unfortunately, we were in a limousine, and we were on the way back from Philadelphia in a car after he'd taped the Mike Douglas show. But when we pulled into New York, I turned to him and I said, I'm planning to tell everybody that I just slept with Richard Chamberlain.
Because you both fell asleep in the car. Right.
We both fell asleep in the car, and nobody believed me.
Not even that.
He was lovely, by the way. He is lovely. He's a lovely, lovely man.
I thoroughly agree.
Yeah.
So
yeah, he was much nicer to me when I asked him about Breakfast at Tiffany's than Mary Tyler Moore was. But that's another story.
Yeah, you've told that story.
Yes, indeed. Many times. And I'm not through telling it either.
Go right ahead.
No, not now. They've heard it. Anyway, we're talking about you, Susan.
Oh,
this is
John
Knight.
And I have to tell you that, I mean, you all know me and you know that my job is to make other people look good. And it's a mighty strange experience to be the one in the spotlight.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting phenomenon.
Do you have a press rep for the book?
Mm.
The other day, somebody said to me, you couldn't pay for this publicity. And I said, and nobody is.
Good answer.
You could finally put the shoe on the other foot and say to some of your actor friends, well, this is a project. We don't have a lot of money. And he's pulling it together. And
that's
we'll
right.
Be great.
Yep.
You know?
Well, I have to say, people have been hugely supportive and hugely generous and very kind. And I'm very grateful because, you know, this is a big deal for me.
Sure.
And it's very exciting. I've got all kinds of lovely opportunities that have come my way. Talking with you three is one of them.
God,
you know, this is fun and a little odd.
So, Susan, I don't have the book yet, and I have to get a copy, but I wanted to ask...
I think I might be able to help you there.
You might? Do you know somebody?
Yeah, I know somebody. I know a person.
I wanted to know how you ended up as a press rep.
Oh, that's interesting. I think I always had the gene. I in college, I was always, you know, helping to beat the drum. And
where did
when
you go
I,
to school?
Go ahead.
Where did you go to school?
I grew up in New York. I went to Hunter College Elementary School. I went to Hunter College High School. I graduated from NYU with a degree in English and theater, and then I got a master's degree at Columbia at Teachers College. So I'm deeply educated.
Yeah.
nobody much cares, but I am. But all through school, I was always the one that would go out and, you know, kind of generate publicity one way or another. And when I was in college, I actually participated in a publicity stunt, although I'm not quite sure I knew what it was. And eventually wound up working for the press agent for the show, although I didn't know that either at the time. There was a show called Marathon 33 with the wonderful Julie Harris. And I had seen it and loved it. It was put on by the Actors Studio. And I went back to buy another ticket and was chatting with the box office guy. And he said something about the show was struggling. And I said, anything I can do to help? And he said, talk to Iggy Wolfington. Remember Iggy Wolfington, everybody?
Yeah.
Everybody on this phone does. And so I called Iggy Wolfington, and he told me about this little stunt that he was going to do with a little sort of parade and, you know, just to generate publicity for Marathon 33. And I wound up participating in it. And as I say, without knowing it, I was involved with my first publicity stunt for a Broadway show when I was in college. But my first job was actually at Lincoln Center, Inc., the parent company. And I was purely by accident hired to be the assistant to the press director, and was kind of, you know, the young golden girl, and did well. And when they had a cutback, they helped me find another job, and I wound up working for Frank Goodman, who was a Broadway press agent, a very prominent Broadway press agent. He used to handle all the Richard Rodgers shows in his prime, Rodgers and Hammerstein. And so that's kind of how I got my foot in the door.
Wow. You know, and so you're a native New Yorker, and you've stayed in the neighborhood.
I've lived my entire life between within about a 15-block radius on the Upper West Side. It's ridiculous.
Who can blame you?
Well, when you get to heaven, why leave?
Right.
I agree.
I do too.
Absolutely. Well, Susan, thank you so much for joining us. I want to remind everybody that you can get Susan's book at Barnes & Noble, at Amazon, the Drama Bookshop, many other places around there. And
Theater Circle. You can also get it in L.A. at the Samuel French Bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
There's just no telling the places.
Well, we have to send you out on a big tour.
Thank you. I just today was invited to do an event at Barnes & Noble's at the end of October on the Upper West Side.
Well, that's great.
How cool is that?
You bet.
My hometown.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, maybe they'll give you cab fare back and forth.
Yeah.
Right. Well, thank you all very much. This has been fun. And as I say, this is all a new adventure for me. So it's nice to do it among friends.
Good talking with
you. Well, it's good talking with you. Thank you so much. You have a great night.
You too. Night. Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye.
So I encourage everybody to pick up that book and give us your feedback on that, because there's some very, very good stories in there. On to our reviews. Michael got a chance to see Romeo and Juliet. Peter and I are actually going to be seeing it this week. But Michael, why don't you tell us what you thought about it?
Well, I have to say I liked it much more than I thought it would, having heard certain specific things about it. And ironically enough, for what it's worth, one of the bits of staging in the show that got a lot of negative response from some people, I actually thought was one of the best moments. As you all may have heard or read, Orlando Bloom playing Romeo makes his entrance on a motorcycle. And, you know, it's quite a buildup to the entrance, and he comes around the back of the set, and you hear a lot of noise, and it's a real motorcycle, and he rides on, and he's got his helmet on, and then he stops, and he takes off his helmet, and he gets a tremendous hand from the audience, as you might imagine. And people sort of laugh, but I don't think it didn't come across as a spoof, you know, and I thought, well, what's the alternative? Normally, if, as written and as normally seen, Romeo, when we see him for the first time, he's just moping. You know, he kind of walks on and he's moping about Rosalind, who's he's having problems with his relationship with Rosalind. And I just thought this was a much stronger, you know, more youthful, much more energetic entrance. And God knows, also, you know, I think obviously Romeo and Juliet, like any other tragedy, it helps if you start at a place that's lighter, you know, and not so heavy, and not, you know, people beating their breasts and moping. And if there are moments of energy and lightness at the beginning, it really helps to make the ensuing tragedy all the more potent. So I really like that moment, and I'd be curious to hear what you both think of it when you see it. David Laveau is the director. David Laveau is famous for, I would say, very odd outre bits of staging in everything he's done that I've seen, certainly. In this case, I would say that most of the staging, some of it was very effective. Some of it seemed very superfluous, but I didn't think there was much that really worked against the play. So that may sound like faint praise, but that's what I felt. And I felt the story came through very well, largely because of the excellence of almost all of the performances. Orlando Bloom was terrific. Although he is mostly famous as a movie star, he does have solid stage experience and chops, very solid. And so he was great. He's actually quite a bit older than Romeo is supposed to be, but if you didn't know how old he actually is, I would say he's certainly believable as at least like a young 20s, I would say. And Condola Rashad, who is still quite young, looks even younger than she is. I suppose one of the youngest and freshest and most beautiful Juliets I've ever seen, although Lauren Ambrose also sticks out in my mind for her wonderful performance in the Delacorte a few years ago. But Condola, I thought, was lovely, and I thought she handled Shakespeare extremely well for someone who has not done a lot of that, as far as I know. The cast, very strong across the board. Brent Carver, much different, much more younger appearing, and a lot more energy than the normal Friar Lawrence whom you see. Jane Houdyshell as the nurse. The nurse can be either, depending on how good the actress is, it can really be a trial of a role in certain scenes. But if you know what you're doing and you can play the comedy as well as the pathos, it can really, really pay off for the actress and the audience. And it certainly did in this case. Chuck Cooper gave a very interesting, unusual portrayal of Capulet. Again, I guess emphasizing humor. Especially in the early scenes, but there again, I thought it worked. I thought it worked really very well. Christian Camargo, whom I have not seen on stage that often, but every time I see him, he's really terrific and really very, very good with the verse. I should say in this production, in case you hadn't read, that the Juliet's family, the Capulets, are all black, and the Montagues, Romeo's family, are not only white, but it seems to me that across the board they all have British accents. So that was a very interesting dynamic that was set up here. And the rest of the cast, as I say, was all very strong. Justin Guarini, whom I liked very, very, very much in Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. He did give an odd performance as Paris, but I suspect it was the direction. He came across as extremely unlikable, and I don't think that's the way to go. He was very smug, very unlikable, and I think it's better if Paris is not, Paris being the, I guess, Chino equivalent in West Side Story, for those of you who know that show better. But that was really the only major false step among the performances, I would say. I made some individual notes about certain staging things. Mercutio's death seemed very abrupt. It, for some reason, it did not register as much as it should have, and that was unfortunate, because until then, Christian Camargo was really great. And on that note, I know for a fact that there was quite significant cuts in the text for this production. I think there must have been some lines cut there at Mercutio's death, because it just seemed like he got stabbed by error, and then the next thing he was being carted off the stage, and the next thing you know, we heard that he was dead. It seems to me that normally it goes on a little longer. And another huge, very big cut. I don't think I've ever seen this cut before. In the final scene in the tomb, Paris did not come to the tomb to duel with Romeo and subsequently be killed by him. That's a big cut, you know. I'm not sure. I mean, I guess the director thought, well, we want to focus in on the lovers at this point, but if you cut that, it throws off the balance, and then it's just like a lot of heavy stuff happening and kind of wailing and gnashing of teeth over and over again, and not broken up by the duel. So I think Shakespeare knew what he was doing in having Paris come to the tomb, and I don't think it should have been cut. What else? The lighting in the show is very odd. Many times, and I was saying, well, what are they doing that for? And I don't know why they did that. I think that should have been rethought. There's this weird thing that there's a rope hanging down, sort of stage left, about halfway down stage, and you're like, what is that? And then it turns out that it's a rope of a bell, which Friar Lawrence rings at the very, very last seconds of the show. But the cord is hanging there, it seemed to me, for the entire play. And people actually were bumping into it. And I'm like, you know, what is that, you know, Mr. Laveau? What did you do that for? So little odd things like that. But as I said, most of the staging certainly didn't harm the play, and some of it helped. And the play itself is so beautiful, and the performances in general were so wonderful that I was very, very pleasantly surprised.
All right. So Peter and I are going to go see this later on this week. So we will return with our opinions next week. But Peter got a chance to see Stop Reset, which Michael talked about last week. So Peter, what did you think?
I liked it more than he did, but this is a very confused and muddled play, I'm sorry to say. And it really has such potential. I mean, he's a publisher of African-American literature. He's downsizing. He's going to have to fire one of his four employees. They've all been with him a long time. Some are black, some are white, one is Asian. And they all say, but we're a family. And then they want to stay a family. Yeah, but when the boss brings each one of them into the office and says, well, who should I fire? You know, they're very quick to mention someone else, you know, which I think is pretty real. Anyway, what happens, though, is that the boss, instead of firing somebody, hires someone. The kid who's the janitor, who's one of these real attitude-heavy kids who, because he's doing this menial job, has to take a superior attitude, or else he'd feel like he was nothing at all. So, but the boss gets bilked by it. We don't like to see that happen. And while the kid is computer savvy and does help him at one point and all that goes with that, it's a little simplistic to think that this guy is going to help the company, save the company. That's not much of the point of the play, though. The point really has to do with the fact of how these employees react when they find out this kid's been hired. The young man is black, and one of the black guys on the staff makes no bones about the fact that he doesn't view this black man as his equal, and certainly says words that one wouldn't expect under these circumstances, or any circumstances, but he says them. So I've talked about this play to a lot of people. I'm used to talking about it, and I always seem to me that I make it sound much more interesting than it seemed to be while I was sitting there. Nicely enough acted. No quarrels there.
How about that set, huh?
Something a little strange about the set, because, you know, there are times when it seems like there's a wall separating his office from the rest of the other people's offices, and then there are times when it doesn't seem to be. So Regina Taylor, who also directed as well as wrote the play, I don't know. I think one job would have been plenty for her, frankly. And I'm sorry that she overextended herself.
Which is sort of what Michael said last week, isn't it?
Well, we certainly agree that the subject matter is so interesting, and that does make it doubly disappointing that it did seem so muddled. Were you confused, Peter, by what was supposed to be actually happening and what was sort of like fantasy dream sequences?
Yeah, there was some of that, wasn't there? I think I got it straight, but I can understand. I will tell you, people around me were certainly making very clear at the end of the show that they didn't get it. There was a lot of complaints at the end of the show. So I don't think this is going to be an audience pleaser, and I think Signature Theater Company is going to be about as far as it gets.
Yes, so, that, I think I mentioned last week that I really, it's very rare to me to experience this, that at the end of the performance that I saw, that the applause was extremely tepid.
Yeah, mine too.
Yeah, I really don't see that very much.
Mm. Well, Michael, yep. I'm sorry, I was going to move on. Peter, were you going to say something?
Well, what I was going to say is, yes, he's right, because usually people are polite.
Yeah.
You know, these are real human beings up there. They're going to hear it, you know, and as a result, you don't blame the actors, because they didn't make up the words. So, but yeah, this time they didn't care enough to applaud warmly, and as if to say, look, you did the best under difficult circumstances.
So, Michael, was there warm applause at BAM when you went to go see Anna Nicole?
Oh, there sure was. It was terrific. I enjoyed it so much.
Wonderful.
I think it was a huge success. This is a co-production between BAM and City Opera. And in his very astute review for the New York Times, Anthony Tomasini said more or less to the effect of how sad it is that City Opera should have such a great success with this, hard on the heels of the announcement that they're tremendously in debt and will very likely have to cancel the rest of their season, limited as it is, unless they come up with something like $20 million in I don't know, 2 weeks, or some ridiculous thing like that. And I, who knows the background. City Opera very, famously moved out of their longtime home, what used to be called the New York State Theater at Lincoln Center, a couple of years ago, as a cost saving measure. And when you think of the tremendous amount they must have saved by doing that, I guess a lot of us hoped that they were buying a lot of time in terms of survival of the company. And, they've been performing in various places throughout the city. But now, now we hear that it really looks like it might be curtains, final curtains. And that is so, so sad. But back to this show, this opera, absolutely terrific. It's composed music by Mark Anthony Turnage and libretto by Richard Thomas, who are the same team who created Jerry Springer, the opera. I actually like this one far more than that one, although I like that one as well. But this, the music is much more varied. I really liked it because to me it's modern. It's music that you immediately know it's modern. There are sections such as the opening chorale, which is sung by basically a bunch of reporters or paparazzi, and that kind of sounds like almost a throwback to Mozart or early Verdi. But then there are many passages that are jazz inflected and all different types of modern sounds. So you would never, you immediately know it's a modern opera, but it's not a trial to sit through and listen to, like, for example, this awful thing, The Tempest by Thomas Adès, that got rave reviews from all the musical press at the Met last year or 2 years ago, whenever it was, because a lot of critics, damned if it's not true. I still can't quite believe it, but a lot of classical music and opera music critics seem to feel that something has to be either atonal or sound atonal or be incredibly dissonant or not have anything to do with conventional structure in order to be taken seriously. But I'm happy to report that Anna Nicole is not like that at all. It was really terrific. and it was in the beautiful opera house at BAM, which I've almost never been in, but it's really quite gorgeous and also historic, as among other things, it was the place where Caruso gave his final performance. It's awful to say, but he I don't remember what the opera was, but he was on stage singing and he started to spit up blood because his vocal cord hemorrhaged. And then it turned out he was dead not long after that. So I mean, that was 1924 or something like that. So it's a place with an amazing, amazing history. But this show, this opera was terrific. Sarah Joy Miller was Anna Nicole, and she was absolutely phenomenal. So beautiful, and with such a beautiful voice. It's almost as if I had been told it had been written for her, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't think it was, but that's how terrific she was. We had Rod Gilfrey as Howard K. Stern. He was really terrific. We had some Broadway people who didn't have a lot to do, but it was so great to have them in it. James Barber was Anna Nicole's father, and Mary Testa was her aunt, her beloved Aunt Kay. And Ben Davis, who's basically an opera singer but has done some crossover stuff, was her first husband. Christina Sajus was in it. These are names that a lot of people are going to recognize. J. Howard Marshall, the second, Anna's billionaire second husband, was Robert Brubaker, who has done a lot at City Opera, and he just made a meal of the role. He was fantastic. It was interesting to me because I only knew the very, 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 very basics of the Anna Nicole story, because it's just something I was never really into and never really got interested in. But they made it into quite an interesting opera. It reminded me of Evita sometimes. Just the whole arc of her, you know, from absolute nothing to this incredibly famous woman, and then to die at such a young age. So I think that Anna Nicole is going to be done again. And, you know, a lot of these operas, and there were a lot of operas in the past several years that have been written about famous people. Jerry Springer is another example. And also, and you always wonder, well, you know, is it just a gimmick? How much, you know, is there any there? Is it going to be really worth it? Or is it just going to be something that people, you know, choose to write about Anna Nicole because she's so famous and people will come to see it for that reason? In this case, the quality is really there. And I was very, very, very happy to see it.
So it's playing through the 28th of September at BAM, as we mentioned, in the what they're saying, the Peter J. Sharp Building, the BAM Howard Gilman Opera House.
And yet another Peter J. Sharp.
Yeah, that was my point, yeah.
Is he on the Sharper Image, I wonder? You know, yeah. Is that where the money comes from? Yeah, could be.
So, you know, with this is quite this revitalization of downtown Brooklyn. Is it going to be the next off Broadway? So,
well, of course, Theater for New Audience is moving there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's going to be wonderful. It's great that Brooklyn is having this renaissance. all the talk about how it never recovered from the Dodgers leaving. and it was nice. It's interesting, too. You may have heard that there was the first professional hockey game ever played at the Barclays Center the other night. It was an exhibition game. But nevertheless, it's a pro hockey team game. And, so it's just wonderful to hear. I mean, it's just great. I mean, there's enough room for everybody. We need the room in Brooklyn for all the people who want to come to live in New York, and how that borough has transformed itself is really something, and it will continue to.
And so easy to get to BAM.
It really is, isn't it?
From Manhattan. As I say, I haven't been there that often, but it's just really easy and quick. And there's so many wonderful restaurants, very reasonably priced, you know, maybe not for long, but as of now they still are. So I would, yeah, I'm, you know, just always check out what's going on at BAM and make it a point to get out there, because you won't be disappointed.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised if it takes less time to get to Brooklyn than it takes to get to the Richmond Shepherd Theater or the old Playhouse 91 and 91st Street, very far east. Those are tough places to get to. Yep.
Well, just as an aside, I just quickly looked up the Peter J. Sharp Foundation. They gave away $21 million last year. Mm. So get on that list.
Well, thank God that they're doing it for the arts.
Yeah, absolutely. So. But perhaps they could name something else. You know?
Does he have a wife or something?
The title.
Maybe they're
it's
in the
funny, because I was in Lou Esther Hall yesterday, and it's so funny that it's called Lou Esther Hall because, of course, it's named for Lou Esther Mertz. And there's something about Mertz Hall, you know, that just doesn't sing. And I think some of that has to do with I Love Lucy as well, of course. But nevertheless, it is interesting that everybody else uses surnames, but here's Lou Esther Hall. Mm.
So, Peter, you're going to help me with this next title, because I wrote it down and I don't know the pronunciation of it. But the elevated repair services are
Arguendo
at the Public Theater, where Peter saw that show. So tell us about it.
Well, you know, this is the group that did Gats. And what they did, of course, was take the entire Great Gatsby and a bunch of actors read it while doing other things. It wasn't just standing at podiums or anything like that. This is also taking something verbatim, and yet it only lasts 80 minutes. Many people will be happy to hear because Gats was an all-day affair. But what this is about is a 1991 Supreme Court case about obscenity. Some exotic dancers, shall we call them, in Indiana felt that dancing nude was really the way they expressed themselves. And after all, you know, the First Amendment should protect that. So that's what the court case is about. And you actually are hearing transcripts down to, I'm telling you, coughing. I mean, even the coughs that were in the transcript by the judges or anybody else were reported. And so you hear them occasionally clear their throats or what have you. So they really do take it to the letter. Now, Lord knows it's not the entire trial. They do edit it down, to say the least. And it's very interesting that four actors play the nine judges. They all think from time to time. At one point, you know, somebody will say Rehnquist, and a moment later it will say O'Connor. You know, so I mean, there's no consistency about that, and they don't care about that, and they shouldn't. So the one woman does look like Ruth Ginsburg, who comes in later. It really is something to see your tax dollars at work, you know, knowing that this case had to go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is dealing with whether or not there should be nudity in a club in Indiana. I mean, don't we have more important things on the agenda? And they're looking for loopholes, for straws, anything. Side is trying the best it can to make its point. I mean, there's talk about, well, if there was nudity in an opera. By the way, Michael, is there nudity in Anna Nicole?
Sorry, I was muted. Is there nudity in it? No.
Okay. Well, this comes up in Arguendo because one of the justices say, well, you know, if there was nudity in an opera, would we take it to heart? Would we be upset about it the way we are here? Is the venue an important thing? Mm. Is the fact that more lofty people go to opera than go to these clubs? I mean, will it lead to prostitution and rape and all this kind of stuff if guys or anybody else, for that matter, goes into these clubs? So it really is something to see. What happens? I mean, we do have C-SPAN, we can see these things, but somehow the theatricality of it is really something. And if it seems like a circus, well, the director certainly has made it a one-ring circus, because there's a lot of they're in like those chairs that you see in the logo of the original How to Succeed, where they circle around either the person who's defending the action or protesting the action. So there's a lot of that. And also you see the transcript on the back wall. It zooms in, zooms out. You might go home with a headache because of that. But nevertheless, they want to prove to you in black and white that these things were said. And they're right there. My favorite thing, by the way, was the fact that at one point there's talk of a bookstore. And the word bookstore is in quotation marks, because really, these things are not bookstores. You know, I mean, you know, they're just not. You know, so I thought that was really great to find out that in the Supreme Court transcript, they didn't want to just call it a bookstore as is. They had to make a little editorial comment with the quotation marks.
Alrighty, so that wraps up that. And Michael got a chance to see the old friends. So Michael, why don't you tell us about that?
You know, I'm going to be brief. I just don't get Horton Foote.
Oh.
I just do not get him, with the single exception of A Trip to Bountiful, which I think is an absolutely beautiful play.
Uh-huh.
I don't know why. What is different about that one? Everything else, this play, I believe, has gotten uniformly positive reviews for the play itself. Do you have that impression, Peter?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I disliked it intensely.
Wow.
I dislike all of the characters. I find the dialogue repetitious. Couldn't believe the way that the author stooped to the way that a gun is used at the end. I disliked it intensely. I just don't get him. Do not.
We all do.
But isn't that interesting that one play, I think, is just, I'd love it.
Yeah, I do too.
You know, I must say I don't know much of his work, and I don't know any of his film work other than the film of The Trip to Bountiful. I know that he's Tender Mercies, which I believe one of the stars was Betty Buckley, who was one of the stars of The Old Friends. That's very highly regarded. So I suppose I should see some of his film work, but I don't know also if that's, you know, completely representative, because as I think we're all aware, film scripts tend to be more not as purely the author's work. I mean, there are more hands involved and you know, more editing that tends to be done by other people. I probably should check that out, because I just don't get it.
All right, so that's at the Signature Theater, and it's playing through October 13th. So if you want to see what Michael doesn't get, that's this is a place to start.
Pretty great cast. Vianne Cox.
That's nice, yeah.
Potter Smith, the aforementioned Miss Buckley. Let's see. Novella Nelson. In a very small role. Novella Nelson, you know, I mean, she's really a name from the world. I know her from Pearly. that was so great for me to see her on stage. I'd never seen her on stage. Oh, and I should say that I thought Hallie Foote was excellent, and I have disliked her intensely in every other Horton Foote play that I've seen, mostly because I felt that in the past she always played the same character the same way, regardless of what the play was. She's very different in this, so I was happy to see it, if only for that, because that really impressed me.
And this is at the Signature Theater's Diamond.
Yep.
So and that's quite a building, isn't it?
It sure is. It's quite a theater factory. I still haven't decided if I like it or not. It's so...
Really? Why? I mean, I think it's terrific. Tell me why.
Well, no, and sometimes I do too, but it just, it can seem like right before showtime that it's almost like an airport lobby, you know, which I guess that's okay, but it just seems a little, can seem a little impersonal. It seems like just kind of a, you know, moving people in and out, kind of cold in a way. But on the other hand, you know, they have a great snack bar and lots of comfortable chairs you can sit around in, you know, and certainly lots of room at intermission. You know, I mean, you don't feel crowded. It's you know, there are sometimes when the amount of space seems like a big plus, and sometimes when it seems like a negative. So whatever.
All right. So next week, Michael is not going to be able to be with us, but Peter and I will be here, and we'll bring in a surprise guest. So Michael, what are you off to do? You have to have some fun at the, what is it, at the
Tennessee Williams
Theater Festival. That's right.
In Provincetown. Yes. It's they've been doing it for quite some years, but it's my first time actually making it. And let's see. They have a lot of very obscure items on the bill, including something called the Chorus Girl Plays, There's In the Summer House, there's slapstick tragedy. The milk train doesn't stop here anymore. And then the big ticket item, I guess, is Cat on a Hot Tin Roof with Keir DeLay switching roles. He had famously played Brick on Broadway in 1974. So that's 40 years, right? Is that the right math?
Yeah.
And he was very good in it, too.
Yes, that's right. You said you had seen him. He was Brick opposite Elizabeth Ashley as Maggie and Fred Gwynne as Big Daddy. And now he is Big Daddy himself. And his wife, the very talented Maya Dillon, is playing Big Mama. And the show opened at the Wellfleet Harbor Actors Theater first. And now it's transferring to Provincetown. And it's been very, very well received. So I am really looking forward to that. I interviewed Keir and Maya, so I can send that link to you, James. Maybe you can put it with the show notes.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. And Peter, last week you were going to have an event at the Drama League for Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it went very nicely. What's so great is you're with people who really care about the same type of thing you do. And I may have spoken with Gabriel Shanks, who's a head honcho there, and we just talked about the book for about an hour. But I would say that after that, people stayed around and we talked for another hour, which was really great fun, as they gave me their opinions on what musical should have won, should have lost, all that kind of business. So a good time was had by all. It was very, very nice. And you know, this is a cute little space, which is at 32 Avenue of the Americas in the AT&T building. So that's where the Drama League has moved, and their offices are quite handsome. And this cute little theater space really accommodates very nicely such events. So if anybody's looking for a place for an event, maybe they rent it out. I don't know if they do. But a very intimate, nice, comfortable chairs, and a good time was had by all.
What's the cross street, Peter?
Walker, I think. You know, the thing is, if you get out the subway at a certain spot, I don't know what spot that is, it just happened to be the luck of the draw. I went up, and there's actually an entrance to the AT&T building from the subway. So you just go right up there, and they're on the lobby level, so it's not hard to get to.
Oh, I thought AT&T was up in the 50s, so off of Rockefeller Center.
Well, this is definitely called the AT&T building. Whether or not they had to expand, maybe this is just where cell services, who knows?
Okay.
They're doing all right, that AT&T. They can afford to have a couple of offices here and there. So, but I guarantee you it's the AT&T building.
Yeah, I suspect they have more than one.
Oh, no, absolutely. Sure. So anything coming up for you, Peter, this week that we should look forward to?
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to old friend Anne, Romeo and Juliet, to see if I agree with Michael pro or con on either one of them. So that will be interesting. I'm seeing Mr. Burns, the very controversial Mr. Burns.
Oh, wow.
Have you been?
No, you must tell us.
Yeah, I mean, you know, love and hatred I'm telling you, not since The Flick. You know, The Flick was a play that really polarized a lot of people, but this one is even more extreme, it seems to me. Bless you all, the Harrow Room review from 1950 is going to be done. I'm going to that. And also I'm going to a play called The Morons, which obviously is a very prestige property, you know, so we'll see what happens with that. So that's pretty much my week, which is adding up.
Great.
In early October, I'm going to be seeing A Streetcar Named Desire at the Yale Rep with Joe Manganiello. Mm-hmm. So I'll be able to tell you all about that.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Not next week, but the week after on Sunday the 6th, October 6th. The three of us are going to be talking with Adam and Betsy from The Last 5 Years off Broadway at Second Stage. So that's coming up as well soon. And we have a lot of things on the agenda coming up and a lot of openings coming up. So please stay tuned with us. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. That way, if you subscribe, you won't miss any episodes. You'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. You can also listen to us on the Stitcher app. The Stitcher is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. And you can stream directly to that device. Or you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information as well as some links to some of the things we talked about today are on the show page at BroadwayRadio.com. And if you want to touch base with Peter, Michael, or me, please, all of our information is there, and do so. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, I'm so sick.
Are you infectious?
Yeah, I am.
Oh,
goodbye until tomorrow. Goodbye till I recall how to breathe. For I have been waiting for you. I stand on a precipice. I struggle to keep my balance. I open myself one stitch at a time. Finally, yes, finally now. Finally, something takes me away. Finally, free. Finally, he can cut through these strings.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio. It's This Week on Broadway for...
Okay. Leave it in.